I'm expecting.
Add all of those drivers together. If you're not thinking that about 40 to 60% of every single thing your business does has to be reimagined, you have to unlearn and relearn it in the next 3 to 5 years. Well, your initial, exactly, good heavens, is your initial response. So your initial response is that fight, flight, flee kind of thing. But then, if you get over that and if you accept that as the reality, I think, and this is the, in my mind, what I like to bring to this conversation, couldn't that also be exciting? If this is now the given, so if once you've got over the initial grief, I don't know if I can handle that. Well, that's a fair response, right? So we can't ignore it. That's a fair response in the face of what I've just said. But then once you've given yourself a few days to accept that and adjust, and again, I'm now in your space because I'm sure just there's a grief process almost that you go through, the initial kind of, you know, bargaining and then anger and then, you know, and then eventually you get to acceptance and say, okay, well, if that's the case, let's get on with it. Then isn't that exciting? Because now suddenly you've got 3 to 5 years where you're going to be learning a whole lot of new stuff. I don't know how many people are scared of learning. I don't know how many people hate growing and developing. Surely not. Surely this is exciting.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. Here we get to chat to some of the world's most interesting and influential people about everything to do with physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. If you want to make healthy changes and live a better life, you are in the right place. Please don't forget to rate, leave a review, and share with everyone who wants to live their best life. And now your host, Nikki Robertson.
So today I have the legendary Graham Codrington on the show, known worldwide as a coach, speaker, facilitator, and strategy consultant. Graham, welcome to the Reinvent Health Podcast.
Thank you, Nikki. That's a very kind introduction.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, you know, we met briefly a couple of weeks ago at the BID Foods conference, and I remember you speaking quite in depth about how we live in an age of disruption. And, you know, from my point of view, when people feel resistant to change, they get ill. So resistance to change is so inherently human, and it's one of our biggest stresses of the day and age. And I don't think we're taught to embrace change or to invite it into our lives in a way that, you know, where we can get it to work for us. So how, from your point of view, given, you know, your massive amount of experience in corporate, I mean, you've been doing this for years, how do we realistically overcome innate resistance to change and start embracing where the world is going?
Nikki, I think you're spot on with your analysis. You know, I don't actually think that people are really resistant to change. I mean, we change our clothes every day. We would hate it if we had to eat the same food at every single meal. Some of us have had the same hairstyle for many, many years. That's me. But, you know, we like change when we have control of that change, when we understand the value and benefit that that change will bring us, when we don't feel that we will lose anything in the process. And so, you know, we often think and say that, you know, people don't like change and we have to deal with change management. I don't think so. I think that what we need to do is we need to get people to be more comfortable with thinking about the future. That they need to be more comfortable with being uncomfortable, because I think maybe it's always been the case. Maybe you can go back 300 years and obviously people then were worried about the future. But I do think that we live at a remarkable moment of history where it's not just that things are changing. Things have always been changing. Things will always change. But there are moments in history when the change is not just fast or slow, but it's structural. In other words, right. It's also changing direction. And we're moving into unknown paths and misty forests and whatever pictures work for you. But it's not just that change is fast and unpredictable and disruptive, but it's also structural. So we find ourselves at a moment in history, at a moment in time, when this change can be overwhelming. And the skill is not to be better at handling change, I think, although there are some skills there, and I think those are valuable skills, so get them if you can. But for me, my focus has always been on helping people do a better job of anticipating the future and of also realizing that in that participation in anticipating the future, they can be involved in actually creating some of that future for themselves. Not in a woo-woo kind of way that you can just imagine something unreal into being, but maybe we can unpack this thought a little bit more, because it comes down to issues of confirmation bias. It comes down to issues of engaging with embracing what we don't know and seeing that as an exciting thing rather than a scary thing. And it involves what I call anti-fragility. But anyway, now let me not just have a conversation with myself, because I think those are some of the themes we could unpack.
There are so many themes we can go into here. So before we get going, you are marketed or promoted, for want of a better word, as a futurist. So what is a futurist?
I'm always debating myself with that word. It is a word I enjoy, and I have it on, well, I say I have it on my business cards. I don't have business cards anymore, but it's on my website. And it's there to be provocative, although I hope it doesn't backfire on me, because I think some people have this picture of me being in a caravan at the local park with a crystal ball and velvet curtains, you know, that exactly. And of course, that's not what it is. Nobody can predict the future. But what we can do is improve our skill set to anticipate where disruption might come from, to scan the horizon a little bit better and make more sense of what's there. It can be very confusing when you just see a list of all the new technologies that have been invented. And then you wonder, well, which of these are just fads and which of these will actually change our world? So that's what I call horizon scanning and separating out the noise, the signal from the noise. There's a lovely book by that name. That's kind of what you're trying to do. And then the third thing is scenario planning, which is to say we can't be precise in anticipating or scanning. So what we also need to do is be aware of all the possibilities, Well, I suppose you do have to think about the crazy, crazy possibilities. 5 years ago, we wrote a scenario, for example, in which we said, what would happen if one of the new viruses that emerges somewhere turns into a global pandemic that forces everybody to quarantine? And we sent this scenario to our clients and we said, just think about it. Just give it a little bit of thought. And a few of our clients came and said, well, you're crazy. That'll never happen. Of course, it can't happen. I mean, what? The whole world in quarantine. And we said, well, I know it's crazy, right? But just think about it. What would happen if, you know? Exactly. And so we're not saying we predicted COVID. We didn't. But we did know it was a possibility. On the crazy edge of possibilities, but a few of our clients who took us seriously and gave us half an hour of their time quickly were able to go back to their memory banks and say, oh, we've dealt with this before. We've thought about this. And literally in March, April of 2020, even having half an hour of head start made a huge difference to everybody, made a huge difference to our team in terms of our responsiveness to change. So there's an example of scenario planning where even if you come up with a crazy, crazy scenario, you've trained your brain, and it's less about being precise in your prediction and more about developing the skill set of being able to say what would happen if. So yeah, there's a long answer, but that's what a futurist does. My company's name is Tomorrow Today. So half my time is spent trying to anticipate tomorrow, but actually half of my time, and maybe the more important half, is saying, and what can we do today to prepare ourselves for whatever might happen?
So, you know, the old school thinking was that the past is a predictor of the future. And we know this is absolutely, well, perhaps, maybe to a very small extent. But what it sounds like, you know, from what you've just explained, it's more about being creative and creating a reframe in your brain about possibility that builds that anti-fragility you spoke about.
Look, we mustn't throw the past away. I read as many history textbooks as I can get my hands on. I love history. And Mark yeah. Twain, mm-hmm. the old American author, said, you know, history never repeats yeah. itself, but it does rhyme.
Yeah, typical Twain.
I love that. And so there are patterns. Nothing ever happens for the first time. You know, everything's building on everything else. And human beings are human beings, and they are predictably irrational in the way that they deal with the world around them. So understanding some history, understanding some psychology, understanding some human dynamics, all of that is part of the futurist's job. But in doing that, you also then realize when you reach a time when your experience and your expertise and your education and your past are no longer useful. And that, if we mm-hmm. can put a label on that, that's when you cross over from using your technical expertise in order to succeed. In other words, relying on everything you know yeah. and everything you are to be able to solve a problem that you can engage with. And you mm-hmm. that's a technical expertise. And you've got to switch over into adaptive expertise mode, which is realizing now is a time of new learning, new systems, new paradigms, new approaches, and experimentation rather than experience, engagement with change rather than reliance on existing systems. And so part of the job of a futurist is to kind of shout and wave a big warning signal to say to people, the old road is closed. You've got to take this detour now. You've got to get on this new path. And that's part of the stress, Nikki, that you led with in this conversation. The stress is when people are yeah. not recognizing that shift into an adaptive era or an adaptive moment.
Yes. Sure. And, you know, just thinking about the organizations that I've been working with, listening to you, isn't it really challenging? The bigger the organization, the more difficult it is to change this mind shift. Because, does it start at the top, or is it something that is a company culture? What is your experience with getting organizations to think differently, and how challenging is it? Has it got something to do with company size, or is it ethic?
What a question. I mean, this can take us into our third hour of conversation. I think you've sort of given me a whole lot of options to choose from, and I wouldn't choose from your list. I would just say yes. It's all of those. So let's unpack the few that you said. So is it culture? Absolutely, it's culture. So you can have a small organization that refuses to change. One of my clients at the moment, well, let's call them ex-clients. They're unlikely to listen to this podcast, but I won't mention their names anyway. But I was working with them. They're a small little manufacturing niche, or they're American, so it would be called a niche manufacturing organization. They supply to everybody, and they've got these little components. I won't give too much away. Those people know who they are, but they've got. Only they make them, only they can make them. It's a beautiful company to be in. They make a fortune of money with only about 36 people. But they're at a moment where they recognize that the potential is that their entire market will change, that they can move within a few years. There are possible scenarios in which they move from being the only company that can supply this component to the component not even being used anymore. So they need to be thinking what happens next. And they are struggling, to put it frankly. So they know the problem, but they are so embedded in what they do, how they've always done it. They are so good at what they do that they struggle to change. The best-selling business book of all time, I think, is Good to Great by Jim Collins. Maybe it comes in just after Who Moved My Cheese. But anyway, it's top five. And it's a great title. And the opening line of the book, I probably am paraphrasing rather than quoting directly. But it's the main reason that companies don't become great is that they are already good. What an opening line to a book. And then they talk about the fact that this book is not for companies that are struggling. It is for companies that are already good but want to be great. And I think, Nikki, the problem is not the companies that are struggling. Companies that are struggling know we've got to do something different. We've got to change. Right. But companies that are doing really well, but in their doing well, they are not recognizing the fact that they are doing well on a road that's got this road closed sign coming up quite quickly. And so they've either wait for the crisis to hit, so they hit the barriers at the end of the road, or, you know, something forces them off the road. Maybe I'm stretching this analogy too far now, but, you know, a crisis will hit them and they'll be so blindsided they can't do anything. So it's really difficult for companies that are doing well, whether they're small or big, to make some of these adaptive shifts. The second thing you asked was, does it come from the top or from the bottom? Look, I think it comes from the top, but it also has to come from the bottom, but it starts at the top. So there is a chicken and an egg situation. I do a lot of leadership development work. That's a lot of the work I do. And when I work with the top execs in business, their biggest complaint is that the senior leaders, so that the next level down, do not take the authority, the proactivity that the executive think they've given them. So the executive says, we've given freedom to everybody, but they just are focused on improving the existing system. We wish that they would push us and push the business forward. Then you go and speak to those senior leaders, the heads of different departments and so on. And they say, God, we've got so many good ideas, but the executive just are not open to new ideas. I kind of think, guys, can we just get everybody in the same room here, please? Because I think I can solve your problem. And that's obviously not a communication problem. These people speak to each other all the time. So there's a missing element where everybody wants the same thing, but everybody thinks that nobody else wants it. And that is such a common issue in businesses. And I'm guessing, I mean, you work with these people as well from an individual kind of stress and well-being. I must imagine that's got to be a huge source of stress in business where you believe that you've got some ideas or you've got an approach that you wish you could bring to the business, but you shut down for whatever reason, whether it's psychological safety or systems and processes. Or legal and compliance, or whatever the excuses we give ourselves. I mean, that must be something you see all the time, isn't it?
Everywhere, all the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, let me throw the question back to you quickly. I mean, what do you see in that situation? Because I think we're talking about the same thing. I just look at it from an organizational strategy perspective. You're looking at it from a personal and team's well-being perspective. But I'm guessing we're seeing the same thing. What do you think it is that's the blockage? And how could we unblock it?
Exactly. So what I see, and I see this more so with South African companies than the international companies that I'm working with, where the execs and the stakeholders really understand the value of healthcare, of mental health and wellness, and of resourcing themselves and their exec teams with skills so that they can look after themselves so they can be more available to their teams. But when we get to that senior leadership level, it starts to wobble. And it's not because they don't want to be healthy, but it seems like there's a disconnect between that exec and the senior leadership level. And I don't know what it is, but it seems to be more prolific here. And I think it's because we work in a state of panic in South Africa. We're always, instead of thinking ahead and predicting or getting creative about what could happen, is we're working from a state of survival more than, and I'm assuming, I could be way off topic, but we seem to be working in survival all the time. Now, when you're working from a point of view of survival, you're looking out for yourself, taking time to recover is very much secondary because we're in the fight phase of that survival pattern that our brains naturally gear ourselves to. So it's about today and looking after today and putting out today's fire, not necessarily thinking about what's going to happen to me in 6 months' time, whether we're looking at that from what's going to happen to the organization 6 months to a year, worst case scenario, or what's going to happen to my health 6 months to a year. We often see young CEOs, young members of an exec board who are relatively healthy, but not thinking down the line. And those are the people who end up with strokes, end up with diabetes because we're in panic.
There are additional factors in South Africa that just create a baseline level of stress for us because of the country that we live in. But although I'm based in Johannesburg, about 75% of my work is international, which has been fascinating during COVID, of course, because all of that's gone virtual. It's changed my life completely. I used to spend 200 days a year on the road, sure, traveling internationally. And I can tell you that more during COVID, I think COVID has closed that stress gap between South Africa and the rest of the world. But, you know, If you cast your eyes around the world, obviously they're hotspots. I mean, imagine the stress of trying to run a business in Ukraine at the moment, for example, or Taiwan or somewhere where there is a potential hotspot growing. But then if we look at causes of stress, you know, if a cause of stress is government corruption and incompetence, well, you know, you can go to Brazil, you can go to Russia, you can go to India, you can go to, and I was just about to get to, you know, we often exclude the so-called, and please, I'm being very, very sarcastic in my tone here, the so-called civilized Western nations. But, you know, Australia has had 6 prime ministers in the last 8 years. The UK, I think, had 3 prime ministers last year alone. You know, you can't talk about corruption and not include America. Politics is a stressful thing in Canada at the moment. You know, so some people might be thinking, well, if I can just leave South Africa, I can just move, or whatever country you happen to be in, and move to another place, then it's going to solve my stress. Then you look at economic conditions and you realize there's low growth almost everywhere. There are industries struggling in almost every country. One of my clients is one of the big banks that was just recently, a global bank, recently affected by the Silicon Valley Bank collapse just a few weeks ago as we record this. You know, and that's huge stress. This is tens of thousands of people who now might be out of work.
Yeah.
And so the list goes on. So yes, I think when your country, the country that you live in, has underlying stresses, that just adds to it. But Mickey, this, I know you know this, but this is an, honestly, it's part of the era that we live in. Part of the era that we live in is the fact that we are living in these uncertain times with deep disruptions to the systems that we live in. And so for me, part of the response needs to be an acceptance of that, an acceptance of the fact that if we're talking about this, let's say, from an organizational perspective, where I do most of my work, let's, if I were to ask a question of an executive team, this is not necessarily how I would phrase it, but let's bring it down to a simple, single question. On a scale of 0 to 100, how much change do you think there will be in your industry in the next year or so? Where naught is, there's absolutely no change at all. What we've always experienced is what we're going to experience, and how we've always worked is the perfect plan for the future. That's a zero. And 100 is our industry doesn't even exist next year. We will have to find new jobs and do something different. So 50 is, you know, halfway between that is, yeah, there's a significant amount of change coming. I would then ask businesses, how much change do you think has to happen? How much of your existing business has to shift? Is it 10%? Because then that's just tweaking. Yeah. Is it 20%? Because that's quite significant to change 20% of something. I mean, that's a significant shift. And my guess is that in many industries, we are heading to 40, 50, 60% difference in the next 3 to 5 years with global geopolitics, climate change, social changes, new generations. I haven't even mentioned technology yet, but that's the biggest driver of all. You know, add all of those drivers together. If you're not thinking that about 40 to 60% of every single thing your business does has to be reimagined, you have to unlearn and relearn it in the next 3 to 5 years. Well, your initial, exactly, good heavens, is your initial response. So your initial response is that fight, flight, flee kind of thing. But then if you get over that and if you accept that as the reality, I think, and this is the, in my mind, what I like to bring to this conversation, couldn't that also be exciting? If this is now the given, so if once you've got over the initial grief, I don't know if I can handle that. Well, that's a fair response, right? So we can't ignore it. That's a fair response in the face of what I've just said. But then once you've given yourself a few days to accept that and it just, and again, I'm now in your space because I'm sure just there's a grief process almost that you go through the initial kind of, you know, bargaining and then anger and then, you know, and then eventually you get to acceptance and say, okay, well, if that's the case, let's get on with it. Then isn't that exciting? Yes. Because now suddenly you've got 3 to 5 years where you're going to be learning a whole lot of new stuff. I don't know how many people are scared of learning. I don't know how many people hate growing and developing. Surely not. Surely this is exciting. You know, I know it's just a reframing rather than actually changing the reality, but I wonder if that reframing might not be a very, very important first step. And just before I give you a pause to jump in, sorry, you can see when you get me talking, it's hard to get me stopped. But I actually think, to loop into what you were just saying, I actually think that South Africans and anybody living in a country that's going through deep structural change, I think that actually gives them an advantage. So you know what? If there were three people who were applying for jobs, and all other things being equal, the only thing different was that one of those people was from Ukraine, I'd hire that person in a heartbeat, because if you're still standing, my friend, after everything you've been through, you must be something of a person. And that's why South Africans who do travel internationally, I don't know a single South African outside of South Africa who's unemployed, not a single one, because we are snapped up internationally, because this underlying stress, which if you don't manage it can kill you, is also a hidden secret asset that can be unleashed for more than just resilience. But this issue of anti-fragility, which we can talk about in a second. But I don't know if you agree with me. There must be a sweet spot between having no stress and having too much stress. And if we can find that, that must be a wonderful place to live.
Yeah, stress is essential, because without it, where's the inspiration? Where's the sense of achievement? But I think what you said, reframing, that is so powerful. You know, it's not just reframing. Reframing is everything. And when you can turn that sense of uncertainty into excitement. I mean, they are literally just a chemical switch away from each other. Fear and excitement go hand in hand. And when you know, very often when I started off speaking in public and on the radio, you get that, you know, when you first start, you get that sense of dread and self-doubt. And I learned very early on that it's actually exciting. This is such an exciting opportunity. And I really had to talk myself through going, okay, fine. Yes, you're nervous, but isn't the, and I just asked myself the question, but it's exciting. And you could feel the change in your brain. And what happens is your, and I'm talking purely from my own experience, is the way we relate to people when we think this is exciting changes everything because they respond differently to us. And then we're changing a group energy. And yes, stress is critically important, but the reframe is the key.
I agree with you. And the good thing is that research agrees with both of us, which is wonderful. Daniel Kahneman, whose book Thinking Fast and Slow is an absolute must read. He won a Nobel Prize for some of the research that went behind it. He's got a new book out, I think last year, called Noise, also well worth reading. So Danny Kahneman talks about the fact that we need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And he means that in the way that we think and how we think. So when we come up with something where we discover we were wrong about something or we are wrong, you can train yourself to, instead of being defensive, which is the typical way, that's unfortunately what 12 or 16 or 18 years of education did for you, because every single time you went into a test, your teacher was trying to show you what you didn't know. I find school assessments to be the one of the most archaic things in a 21st
Absolutely.
Century thing. We should be fundamentally shifting the way that we assess whether people have gathered knowledge. So instead of being scared of not knowing, we are excited about the bits we don't know yet. We are excited to discover gaps in our knowledge. We are excited when we discover we were wrong. Now, of course, it's the initial discovery is not exciting. You're disappointed, you're upset, you're defensive, you maybe even angry that you've maybe been caught out or made to look foolish. But if you can immediately begin the process of shifting that to say, well, just acknowledge it. Nobody, there's not a single human being who has ever lived, who has ever been perfect in their knowledge and perfect in their understanding. And I grew up in a very religious home. And if my mother listens to this, I'm sure she'd shout out the name of the particular deity of our faith and say, yeah, but even the holy books, every single holy book I've ever read indicates that the holy people in those holy books, they were learning, they were growing, they were developing, because it's part, in my opinion, of the perfection of humanity is that we recognize we're imperfect and it irritates us and we seek perfection. Yeah. So we want to improve. We want to get better. We want to know more. We want to correct our mistakes. So then isn't it an exciting time when you discover, hey, actually, there's a better way of thinking about this. There's an upgrade available. Let's install the upgrade. How fascinating. This is wonderful. So there are so many ways that just this very, it's not simple to do initially. It's a skill that you have to teach yourself. But once you get to that point of saying, I've suddenly discovered I have an opportunity to upgrade my thinking. And you invite other people to collaborate with you in doing that. So you say to people, oh, teach me more. Every single person you meet knows more than you about something. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you gave yourself the opportunity to just find out what that thing is and learn from them? And that's what a book is. That's what a podcast is. That's, I mean, literally, if you bring this attitude of urgent, optimistic curiosity, I think all three of those words are important. Urgent, optimistic curiosity. If that becomes your framing device for life, It doesn't solve all of your problems, but it turns your problems into opportunities. It turns your struggles into questions, which ultimately find answers. And I think it helps to turn your stress into a bit of a project plan that will eventually lead you out. So, you know, for me, it just makes sense as a way of being and a way of looking at the world.
Yeah. And yes, being comfortable in a learning space isn't something we're taught. We are so conditioned to be the expert, have the answers. Otherwise, you feel foolish. And it's ridiculous when you know, when you put it down on the table and you look at it, you think, what? That doesn't make any kind of sense. So yes, learning to be a bit more vulnerable in a learning space, especially now in today's day and age where things are accelerating so quickly, is a hell of a useful skill to nurture.
It's a remarkable thing. Our team at Tomorrow Today, we often speak to those senior execs that I was talking about. One of our favorite questions to ask them is, so where does learning happen in your organization? This is a brilliant question for a CEO in particular.
Yeah.
And I frame it in a particular way. I'm trying to lead them a little bit. It's a bit of a trick question, but you know, where does learning take place? And I'll often say, the chief learning officer or the L&D department's like one floor down and in the far corner. And you say, no. I mean, that's the department responsible for courses and content. Uh-huh. But what I mean is, where are the moments, the spaces, the opportunities for learning? And then you can unpack what learning is, and there's all different definitions, and you know, but it definitely includes things like unlearning and relearning. It includes things like self-reflection and correction of things. It definitely includes the opportunity to identify mistakes or weaknesses in thinking or things that could be improved. So there's, you know, now you have a quick conversation, you've got a whole list of things, and you say, so what I'm really asking is, can you just pull out the agendas of your last three executive meetings or your last three board meetings or your last three team leader meetings and show me where learning is on the agenda?
Uh-huh.
And of course it isn't.
No, it isn't.
Even at those senior exec and board level meetings, the amount of times they jump so quickly to operational issues is frightening. Everybody lower in the organization thinks, well, at least the bosses are thinking strategically, because we're just doing our work and we're on a bit of a hamster wheel down here in the basement. But at least on the top floor, some strategic thinking is going, well, if only they knew that it's just a bigger gold-plated hamster wheel upstairs. you know, and so, for example, one of the clients that we worked with, my colleague Keith Coates, he encouraged them to start every meeting with 5 minutes of silence. Now, 5 minutes of silence. If we included 5 minutes of silence at this moment, Nikki, in this podcast, people would think the podcast was over. They'd literally switch off.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
We are not used to having even like 5 seconds of silence. And 5 minutes, imagine 5 minutes. It's a hang of a long time. People can test themselves and see, especially when there's other people in the room. Maybe you're good enough to do 5 minutes on your own, but 5 minutes of a whole group of people sitting around a table and nobody talking.
That's virtually impossible.
Well, it was brutal. Brutal was the word Keith used to describe what he saw. But they developed the ability, and the boss, the CEO said, okay, I'll take this on as a challenge, and with no explanation, just did it. And it was impossible, didn't work, and people were like, what's going on? And he like insisted, guys, I said 5 minutes of silence, it's only been 2 minutes, you know, give us another three. And then the next meeting, they managed to do a little bit longer, the next meeting a little bit more. And the CEO and the rest of the team were absolutely astounded as to how better their conversations were. Literally. Because of this moment, it wasn't even structured mindfulness. I mean, I think there is a word for it, and I think you can do it in maybe a more directed and structured way, but literally just silence, the centering yourself in a moment and just giving yourself the space. And then now be a little bit more intentional about it. Mm-hmm. Add deliberate self-reflection exercises and upgrade our thinking moments and correcting of incomplete logic processes. You know, if you now start to do this deliberately, you're going to say we need an hour of our time with our executive each week to do this. And my answer is yes, I think you do. And I think if you did that, you'd find it was the best hour of your week and the most remarkable contribution to your business. Yeah, but Everybody's just too busy, right? Everybody's got too much work to do.
Yeah, never enough time.
Never enough time to do the things that actually are going to change your world.
So while we're on the subject of not enough time, this is a pet peeve of mine, because whether I'm working with individuals or organizations, the first excuse that comes up is there's never enough time. There's never enough time to exercise or go to bed early enough or to, the list is endless. So let's dig into this idea of there's never enough time, because, it doesn't matter who you are. We've all got the same 24 hours, yet some people will find the time to do what's important to them, where they put value, what they believe is going to make a difference to their lives. What are your thoughts around that story that we tell ourselves of time?
Look, some people need some time management skills. Fair enough. But almost all of us don't need that. That's not the problem. So can I steal something from somebody else? Stephen Covey changed my life when I was about 18.
Perfect.
I sat here and maybe this is one of the things that's made more of an impact on my life than anything else. It wasn't himself. It was somebody from the Stephen Covey organization, but this is one of the things they did. I was sitting in a big hall in an audience, and he puts this big glass jar up on the table at the front, and he fills it with big rocks, sort of fist-sized rocks, and he can get about 10 of them in. And then he puts another one on the top, and it falls off the side. And he says, right, we filled this jar, right? This, you can't get another rock in. And we all nod. So he picks up a big bag of little pebbles, and he starts pouring these pebbles in, and he gets somebody to come up and shake the jar a little bit, and he pours more in, and he says, right, now is the jar full? Because it's now overflowing again. And we kind of all going, okay, trick question. Is it full? It looks full. He says, no, it's not. And he pulls out a bag of sand, and he pours the sand in, and he can pour a hang of a lot of sand in, and he shakes the jar and packs it down and pats it at the top. He goes, okay, now is it full? And we'll go, I don't know. It sounds like a trick again. And he says, you're right. Mm-hmm. It is a trick. And he pulls out a jug of water, and he pours the water in, and a tremendous amount of water can go in before. Now it's sloshing everywhere. Water. He made a big show of this thing. It was a wonderful spectacle. He says, now is it full? And we're all thinking, oh, it's a bit of a trick. And he says, no, guys, it's now full, right? I mean, this is science and physics. You can't get anything else into this jar. So what's the lesson? What's the lesson of this? Let me throw this to you, Nikki. No wrong answers. You might have heard this before. If you have heard it before, give the answer that people might give, or people who have this complaint, I don't have enough time. What do you think those people answer? It was my answer, but what do you think? What's the lesson?
There's as much as we, I don't know. I've got so many answers sitting in my head right now. So,
yeah, no, sorry. You do this for a living. So you're the wrong person to ask, because you can probably think of 20 answers. The typical answer, which was my answer in the moment, is you can always fit more in.
Always.
When you think it's full, it's not really full. You've just got to think creatively and all the rest. You can get more in. And that was the main answer from the audience. And he smiled and he said, good answer, because you can actually. So with a little bit more organization, there's some tools that you can use, like, organizing your priorities, do the easy things first. And
the big things done.
So all of that's important, he said. But that, yeah, exactly. So all of that's good advice. But the real important lesson, and he then got another glass jar, exactly the same size, and he started pouring water into it. He said, if you put these things in the reverse order, so you put the water first, then the sand, then the small rocks, then the pebbles, then the big rocks. He said, if you put them in the reverse order, you'll never get the big rocks in. You won't get the big grux in if you don't do them first. And so the question is, what are the big rocks? What are the things that are most important? So, for example, I put meetings with my family. So I've got three daughters and a wife. I will put meetings with my family, and I've done this for 25 years, put those into my diary on whatever scale you want to, if it's weekly, if it's monthly or whatever. So I'll put birthdays and important events, and I'll put things in, and also just taking out to coffee meetings into my diary. Then when somebody contacts me and says, hey, Graham, I need you to do something for me. Can you do next Tuesday? I'll look in my diary. Here's one of the most powerful phrases in the English language. Sorry, I'm already booked up. Can we look for another time? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to tell them who I'm booked for. Now, when I started this 20 years ago, I sort of was almost embarrassed to tell people that I have an appointment with myself to do some painting, for example, which is what I do every Friday afternoon if I can. Yeah. Or I have an appointment with my 9-year-old daughter to take out for milkshakes. You know, so that today I don't have any issue telling people that's what I'm doing. Sorry, I can't meet with you because I have a family commitment or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to if you don't want to. Now, if your boss is the person who's requesting the time and says, well, Graham, I'm sorry that you already have an appointment in your diary. Could you please move that other appointment because this one's slightly more important? Okay, well, then you can.
Yes.
But the key is, you move that appointment. You don't cancel it.
Yeah.
So if it's an appointment to go to gym, you don't cancel it because it's a busy day. You recognize it's a busy day. What can I do? It's a busy day. I can't go to gym today, but now I have to reschedule.
Yeah.
So I need to reschedule for tomorrow. So if I look in my diary and there's no space for that, you know, that sandwich and milkshake with my daughter tomorrow. Well, then, is there a space the day after? No, there's no space the rest of this week. Look, next week, there's no, good grief, I have to cancel. Well, that should be a red flag.
Yes.
That immediately is like, whoop, whoop, whoop. You are now too busy because one of your big rocks has just been removed from the jar.
And that's a warning.
And so now you are putting a long-term relationship, a spouse, a partner, a child's relationship at risk, literally.
Yes.
This week, I am putting my relationship with my daughter, my lifelong relationship with my daughter at risk so that I can attend a client briefing with my boss. Yeah, well, you know, when you put it that way, it becomes easier for you to realize what you're doing and easier for you to say, you know what, I'm just going to not answer those emails today. Sorry, today's the day that my inbox is too full.
Yeah.
And so today's the day I'm going to get a good night's sleep. I'm going to gym. I'm taking my daughter for milkshake. And that means I'm not going to get to those 50 unread emails. I'm sorry.
So be it.
Something's got to give. Mm. And emails from my colleagues are not big rocks, they're pebbles.
Yeah, that's a great reframe.
I don't know if that's easy or not to do, but I can tell you it gets easier over time and it becomes a lifestyle habit over the years. Mm. And 2.5-3 decades later, you're not going to regret doing that.
No, you're not. And I think people simply need permission to think like that. Nobody ever... Yeah, for so many people, nobody ever put that idea forward and went, well, what are the big rocks in your life? And until you ask that question, you're not going to get that new mental pathway and think differently about your life.
Mm. Mm. And, you know, I'm not saying it's easy because you might work in a toxic company for a horrible boss. And it's all you've got at the moment. You know, I'm not going to give you the advice of a millionaire who's got more money than they know what to deal with. And they just say, well, just leave your job. Obviously, most people can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there does come a time where you still have to say, is it worth it?
Sure.
And I'm not telling you when that time is, but you need to have a system that you know will accurately tell you when that time is. And if you are relying on having a heart attack, on having a breakdown, on your marriage breaking up, on your children hating you, if you are thinking, well, that's going to be the time when I stop doing what I'm doing.
Wow.
Because if you don't have another mechanism to stop you, those are the mechanisms.
Sure.
So those are clear mechanisms. Mm. So if you prefer mechanisms early in your life, well, then work out what those are.
Yeah.
If you haven't had a date night with your spouse in a month, that's got to be at least a warning sign,
sure.
Right? If you've missed the last 3 school activities for your child and here's a horrible one that hits hard in the gut. If your child has stopped asking you to come to school activities, you 1 step before your child hating you forever because they've given up on you already. I mean, that's a horror show already. So you want to be a few steps back where at least you're only still disappointing them by saying no.
Yeah.
Sorry, this has got a little bit dark and deep
True. But
these are the things. So if all of those frighten you and scare you and hit you in the gut like they have, just me contemplating them, then, well, what's the next step before then? And what's the next step before then? And how do you make sure you get those big rocks in? So we feel like we're quite a long way from where we started with thinking like a futurist, but actually we're exactly where my work has taken us.
Yes.
Because this is the future of work and people, which is, as it happens, it sounds like I'm pivoting to a marketing spiel, but I'm not. But it's the title of my latest presentation because I think this conversation we've just had is precisely the conversation that every one of my clients has to have.
Yeah.
We want to, as individuals, work for companies that help us to do this. We don't want to work in companies that say, Graham, all that stuff about being healthy and being well and having good relationships, that's your problem.
Yeah.
That deal with that in the evenings and the weekends. And by the way, deal with it in the evenings and weekends between the WhatsApp messages and emails send you as your boss on the evening. Who wants to work in a company that doesn't take that seriously?
Exactly.
So we want to work in companies that allow us to think these thoughts because then we will be the best version of us that we can be.
Yeah.
And when we are the best version of us that we can be, we bring that to the workplace and the workplace gets what they want from us, which is productivity, engagement, and giving our best. So it is a virtuous circle, but geez, so many of my clients haven't seen it. So for me, I'm almost shaking the executive teams of my clients to say, this is not something that the HR director is responsible for.
Exactly.
This is not something that happens if you've got the time and space. This must be central to your strategic intent for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
If you brought me in to ask, Graham, what do you see in the future? This is what I see.
Yeah.
And I'm giving this insight and foresight to you as a gift. Now, please do something about it. Yeah. So for me, this is the conversation, Nikki, and I'm really grateful for the invitation to frame it in this context of thriving as you do so well, because I absolutely think that this is not this thinking like a futurist, this foresight and scenario planning is not something just for the strategy team and it ends up in a business strategy document.
Right.
It's at the heart and soul of our organizations because it's in the heart and soul of every single person who works for you.
Absolutely. So, yeah, just looking at the clock, I can't believe we've eaten up 57 minutes already. And there's about 10 more questions I have for you, but we'll have to save it for another time.
We'll have to do a part 2. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, that's a lot to think about and a lot to take in. And so much, I hate to use the word again, but it is, again, it's reframing the way we think about living. And just as a precursor to more questions later down the line, that TED Talk you did on how much longer we're living because of technology, which means we're going to be working a lot longer as well. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But yeah, if we're not thinking, all kinds of scenarios, and from my point of view, it's about personal health. From an organization's point of view, it's company health, it's financial well-being as well. We are going to be on the back foot. So perhaps this is just the start.
And I think it is actually at one level quite a simple start to just refresh for people if they've stuck with us for the hour. Mm. Here's what I think you need to do.
Right.
I think you need to become excited about the fact that the future is going to be different. That's a choice you can make. Not the choice of whether the future will be different or not. It will be.
Yeah.
The choice is to say, okay, I'm choosing to be excited, as much as I also acknowledge that I'm a bit scared, but I'm scared excited.
Yeah.
You do that by becoming more comfortable with being uncomfortable in your thinking. In other words, and here there's some resources, let me throw these out quickly. Mm-hmm. Think Again by Adam Grant is possibly the best book I've read in the last 5 years, and I'd highly recommend it. He talks about this, and he's got a wonderful podcast, and he's worth following on social media. Adam Grant is a professor of psychology at Wharton, and he talks about this stuff, and I've learned so much from him in the last 2 or 3 years with this book, Think Again. But it's this becoming comfortable with saying, I don't know, let's find out.
Yeah.
And it's an invitation to, if I can use those words again and make this kind of the last thing to leave with listeners, is this urgent, optimistic curiosity.
Love it.
If you can take those words and say, this is what's going to make the world a better place more than anything else.
Yeah.
Then all the other stuff we've spoken about become tools that you can use. But those are the things you are aiming to do, or the outcomes you're aiming for. And if you can get those, you'll change your life and the life of everybody around you.
Absolutely. That was magnificent. Thank you so much, Graham. I've had such a wonderful sort of part to the day where we can have a conversation like this and just start thinking different. It gets you out of your funk, for want of a better word. So yeah, thank you for that. And if you could please just send me any links that you can think of, links to, I'll obviously put a link to your website, but anything, any resources, your videos, your YouTube talks that people can, you know, take in what you believe in, what you teach, what you, your ethos even more, it would be wonderful.
Perfect. I'll let you have all of those links, and would love to have a whole lot more people joining in my community as we work all of this stuff out together.
Yes, and I believe you're doing courses as well.
Yes,
you've got a whole lot of courses on your site as well, which people can sign up for.
Exactly. People at just grahamcodrington.com, you'll find everything that you need there.
Thank you once again for joining me for another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. As usual, all of my guests' details can be found in the show notes page on Apple Podcast, Anchor, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Please don't forget to rate on Apple and leave a review.